Welcome to the Wicked Wallflowers Club. I'm Jenny Nordback.
And I'm Sarah Hawley.
This week we're joined by Grace Burroughs. She's a New York Times bestselling and five-time Rita Award finalist with Best Book of the Year kudos from the Library Journal, Publishers Weekly, Kirkus, and RT Book Reviews.
In this interview, we talk about her new book, A Rogue of Her Own, how her experience as a child welfare lawyer influences her writing, and how writer's block isn't writer's block at all, but a key part of the process. With no further ado, here's our interview with Grace.
We are here with Grace Burroughs. Hi, Grace. Thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
And we thought we would start with a question that we tend to ask everyone, which is, what is the very first romance novel that you remember reading, if you do remember what the first one was?
The Wolf and the Dove. It was a Kathleen Woodywiss, and in quick succession, I then gobbled up The Flame and the Flower.
And how old were you then?
Probably 12, 13.
That like prime age. It's funny how many of us started right in that age range where I feel like a lot of us point to 12 and 13 year olds and we're like, oh, they shouldn't be reading about that stuff. But that's when all of us got started. So it's interesting that we put different expectations on them than we had for ourselves.
I'm also curious where you found that romance novel. Was it something on a bookshelf in your home that you just grabbed? Was it something you borrowed from a friend?
I remember her name. Her name was Emily. I was in seventh grade. And, you know, it was a situation where you finished lunch, but you had to hang around in the lunchroom. And Emily had her nose in this big book. And Emily, what are you reading? And she held the book up, and the cover indicated that this was a book I was interested in. And she said, I'll lend it to you when I'm done with it. And that was it. My nose has been in a romance novel ever since.
That's awesome. Thanks, Emily.
Yes.
And how did you move from reading into writing romance novels? Because that happened much later on, didn't it?
It did. Decades later. I went to college, I went to law school, I raised a kid. When my daughter moved out, there was this sense of emotional oxygen sort of seeping back into the house. She left home at 17, and that's a very fraught age, and it's a difficult age to parent well. So my nest was empty, and I am a lawyer, and I was in the office one night, late, working on some deadline. A motion was due to the court the next day, and lawyers are, we live deadline to deadline, and when you must be in court, you must be in court, or the judge will hold you in contempt. And this project that I was working on was not going well. I had reached the point where I was so tired, I was very inefficient. And I always have a book with me. And I told myself, you can read one chapter. Just read one chapter. And, you know, then you'll be refreshed and you can come back to the legal task and knock it out in 20 minutes. Well, this book was by one of my reliably enjoyable authors. And I just wasn't connecting with it. It was the wrong book for me that night. And I had the thought that I think has launched many careers. I bet I could write one of these. And I started writing because I had ideas in my head. And like an hour later, the motion was not done. But I had written my first chapter of a romance novel. And that became One of the Lonely Lords. That became Gareth's story.
And how did that lead to publication? Like, how long was the gap between having that initial thought of I can do this better and actually finishing a manuscript and getting published?
It was years, probably 5 years. I wasn't writing for publication. I was writing for joy. There's no TV in my house. There has never been a TV in my house. I read for pleasure. And then the writing gradually supplanted the reading. So manuscript after manuscript was being completed. And this was just like when you plant flowers, you don't expect to become a flower seller. You expect to have a pretty yard. You expect to have had an enjoyable afternoon. That's how I was writing. But I have six brothers and sisters. And when we get together, the question was always, when are you going to get that stuff published? As if
siblings are great for that, aren't they? Like it's just going to fall out of the sky.
Yeah, you go to the 7-Eleven and get a publishing contract. And the kind of law I practice is child welfare law. This is a nice way to say that I deal with child abuse and neglect all day long. And it's good work. My clients are, the dearest people you'd ever want to represent. I represent the children. But I can also see that there will come a time when that profession has served its purpose for me. And I'm going to want something else. And so with that kind of thinking in mind, I figured, what the heck? Why not see if I can sell a book? So I went to a writer's conference. I went to an RWA chapter conference, in fact, and there was an editor there, and I pitched her, and she bought the books, and that's how I got started.
And I do want to say, we have the excerpt from your query letter in your bio, and I want to read it for our listeners, because it sounds like you started your query letter with, I am the buffoon in the bar at the RWA retreat who could not keep her heroine straight, could not look you in the eye, and could not stop blushing. And if that doesn't narrow down the possibilities, your job is even harder than I thought. Which I think is such a charming intro because it shows your wit. It's a little self-deprecating. Obviously, she must have felt the same way.
Well, it was my first writer's conference, and I didn't really know what to expect. And Friday night, they have an agents and editors panel where all of these very bright people sit in the front of the room and hold forth very knowledgeably. And I could not understand what they were saying. They were using acronyms. I don't know. They were referring to processes I'm not familiar with, or I wasn't at the time. And I left the room in a bit of a shame spiral. Figured, well, I'll just go upstairs and write because that's what I know how to do. And I stopped at the bar on the way upstairs and got myself a White Russian, which is my favorite drink. And one was very good, so I ordered another. And I was standing in the bar wondering, have I ever had three drinks? Do I want to have that experience now? Because both of those White Russians were pretty good. And I noticed there was a woman in line next to me, and she had a knitting bag, knitting needles and yarn. And one of the people on that panel, that infernal panel, had a knitting bag. And I don't drink as a rule. And these two White Russians were not helping me connect dots. And I turned to her and I said, am I supposed to pitch my book to her? And she got this long-suffering smile on her face and said, would you like to pitch your book? It was Deb Worksman, who I think is the editorial manager now at Source Books. And she pulled a pitch out of me. Tell me about your books. How many have you written? What theme? What do you think your best work is? And I was completely bum-fuzzled. I did not know that you're supposed to have this sort of 10-second soundbite ready to go, and business cards, and hooks, and elevator pitches. I just bumbled my way through it. But I think any time an editor comes across somebody that has 24 completed manuscripts, they're probably going to give that person at least a little window of attention. And I'm very fortunate that Deb did.
Wow. Yeah. She could see something clearly.
Yes.
So when did you start to consider yourself a real writer?
Well, I don't.
Oh, you still don't?
I just write because I like it. It is a constant source of amazement and delight to me that people are willing to pay money for my books, and that these books get loose and people enjoy the stories. I'm just delighted by that. And if it should all disappear tomorrow, the market shifts, genre fiction evolves, I don't take for granted that I have a readership. I have found some people who enjoy my books, and that pleases me, but you can't take it for granted.
Yeah, absolutely. I read, I don't remember if it was on your blog or another interview that you did, but you did say at some point that writer is an identity, not simply a profession.
Yes. And in that sense, I kept a journal before I could write cursive. When I was 8 years old, my parents gave me a typewriter for Christmas, and I just started typing stories, though I could not type, and I still can't. I've always kept a journal. I wrote for my college newspaper. I've always enjoyed communicating with words. As a lawyer, you must be able to communicate with words. But it never occurred to me that the thing I enjoy so much, which is writing, should be an indicator to me of where my professional aspirations should lie. And I wish it had occurred to me several decades sooner, but it didn't. So I am coming late to the party and having a wonderful time.
Well, we're enjoying the output as well. So we're glad that you figured that out and started to do it. It's funny how you mentioned that it feels like between social media, Twitter and Facebook and everywhere, everyone's got those acronyms that you talked about, and they're posting word counts and pitches, and you know, now pitches are tailored to be the length of Twitter, and it does feel like there's this thing that you're supposed to be doing. And it's interesting talking to you and talking to like Christine Feehan, we had this conversation with, and she was saying like how she did everything wrong, and like they offered her her first book deal and she hung up on them because she just couldn't even wrap her head around the idea that someone would want to buy her book. And just that reminder that it doesn't always have to go perfectly. And I think we writers are an anxious bunch. So just hearing that, you know, you can muck your way through it in those early days and still come out the other end making it work is helpful to hear.
I would go one step further. I sat in some workshop about the habits of highly successful writers. And this workshop was very well intended. Somebody had interviewed many, many bestsellers and looked for patterns in what they do. And patterns, of course, emerged. Every one of these bestsellers had dedicated writing time. Every one of them had written goals that were measurable and, you know, time limited. And every one of them had a business plan. Every one of them had a dedicated writing space. And as I'm hearing this list, I'm sitting in the back of the room getting smaller and smaller because I don't do any of that. I don't have word count goals. I don't have dedicated writing time. I just sort of do my little Winnie the Pooh thing and books result. And I did not put my hand in the air and say to this person, I am the counterexample. If anybody else in this room is feeling what I'm feeling, that I can never get there because I don't do this, I want you to know I've hit the New York Times list 3 times in 4 books. And even with that indicator of success, which granted is a very limited indicator of success, I was still susceptible to the message that you're doing it wrong. I wasn't doing it wrong. But
clearly,
I lacked the confidence, first of all, to say, well, I'm just a different kind of writer from every person she's talked to. And secondly, I lack the confidence to stick my hand in the air and say my truth. And that experience has remained with me. So whenever I address a group, I try to start with, don't do what I do. Listen to what I do. And if it helps, follow. If it doesn't help, chuck it over your shoulder. There are many, many, many roads to Rome.
Yeah, and I think it's something a lot of writers face that actually prevents people from even getting into the writing space. They're like, I'm not doing this right. I'm not writing fast enough. I was just talking with one of my friends yesterday who's been working on a book for about a year. And because I write pretty quickly. I can knock out a book in a couple weeks to a month. He's like, you know, I'm doing this wrong. Like, it's taken me forever. I first had this idea like a decade ago. And it's like, no, this is what I do. This is not what you do. And you are producing something different. And it's whatever works. And it's whatever makes you happy and makes you feel inspired. There's no timeline. No one is pushing this on you or like you have to fit a certain mold. So I really like hearing you say that, and that the fact that you're telling new writers this when you speak to them, like, don't do as I say or as I do. Just take it as an inspiration to find your own sort of magic way of producing your creative works.
Well, there is this notion of the success fallacy. You look at Grace Burroughs, and boy, she put out a lot of books in a short period of time, and they're Regencies, and they have a certain kind of cover. And if I just do what she did, then maybe I will have a readership like hers. Well, first of all, you can't do what I did because time has moved on. And you can write the same stories in the same voice with the same covers, the same word count, and you won't get the same result. And the other thing is, if I had made my books shorter, if I had had a different kind of cover, if I had put them out more slowly, I might have sold even more. You can't look at what somebody has done and say, wow, after, therefore, because of. You can't impute causation as cavalierly as we do.
And how much of what you're describing from your career was strategic on your part, and how much of it is just what happened as a result of publishing? Because I think you're both traditionally and self-published, right?
That is correct. So for the first 30-some books, maybe 40 titles if you include novellas, I was only traditionally published. So my ability to affect strategy was very limited. I was fortunate, though, that Sourcebooks was motivated to keep me traditionally published. So all those manuscripts that were in the broom closet and under the bed hit the shelves in pretty rapid succession. There were some series that Sourcebooks published a book a month for me. And for a traditional house to do that is very unusual. They did not get immediate in-store placement for most of those titles, but the readers still had access to them before it was popular for a traditional house to publish that quickly. So I had some very good luck. However, a discussion went into that decision, and one of the terms that came up was market saturation. If your readers can get a hold of you every month and get a new title every month, there are two dangers. One is they'll get bored with you. You know, they will have read enough of you. They will have reached their limit of eagerness to buy your products. And the other thing is they can come to expect that. And when you can't, you know, scratch the itch at the same rate, they'll go elsewhere. So no matter what decision you make, there's somebody who's going to tell you it was not prudent. I just got lucky in a lot of ways. I hit the right market with the right books with the right publisher, and then I could branch out into self-publishing and be even luckier.
Well, I think people also trying to replicate the success of a particular author by following the same steps, trying the same content, trying to use it as a template, there is an element of authenticity that comes through in writing when you read a book and you know that a person is just so passionate about this idea that it's come from a place entirely within them and that they're sort of telling their story their own way that I think really comes through. And that's, I think, another reason it doesn't always work to just try and replicate something, not just because the market moves on, but because you could kind of tell when a piece is derivative or if it's coming from a place where the author doesn't truly love it.
I'm not sure where I come down on that, because some of the books that I have just figured, oh, it's kind of cute. I like these characters. I want to see what they do. Have become reader favorites. And the books that I feel were a profound contribution to the genre were just kind of another title to the readers. So my barometer for what should be a successful book isn't necessarily well tuned even to my own readership. I'm whatever a writer can do that brings them joy and success according to their definition of success, I'm all for it. If you can write Grace Burroughs knockoffs that aren't plagiarism and, you know, make bank, go do it. I can't do that. I can't read somebody's book that I love. I love Joanna Bourne's books. Everything that woman has written is brilliant. I can't do it. I can't be a Joanna Bourne clone. Yeah, that's just means I have to read her books frequently. You know, she's on my keeper shelf and well-worn. The same with Mary Bailog. The woman is a genius. I can't do what she does. I can't do what Loretta Chase does. And I'm so glad those women are writing. I adore their work.
But yeah, you have to write what Grace Burroughs writes.
Right, yeah.
You've alluded a couple of times in the last few answers to reader expectations, and whether that's how many books you're putting out a year or whether it's the type of book you're putting out. Has that impacted your writing process at all as you have gained a bigger readership, or do you try to just tune it out?
I work for the readers. I am, you know, I can sit on my toadstool and write books all day. But when I put that book on a commercial shelf, I enter into a contract with the readers to provide a certain kind of entertainment. And my first obligation, if I'm going to take their money, is to fulfill that contract. That contract in my genre includes a happily ever after. It includes a central love story, a satisfying ending. And within those parameters of general reader expectations, there's also a Grace Burroughs brand. I draw a certain kind of character. I deliver usually a certain amount of humor. And there are certain moral lines I won't cross. So I have developed a contract with my readers within a contract. They are not only getting a romance from me, they are getting a Grace Burroughs romance. And if I color outside the lines and they feel betrayed, that's on me. That's a risk I might want to take for a certain book, but it's a risk I take knowing that it could cost me readers. They have many, many options and many good options when it comes to entertainment and to reading entertainment. And so I take risks with the relationship at my peril as a brand.
Have you ever been tempted to write something outside of romance under a pen name or just try something different, or does romance really have your heart?
I have thought about women's fiction because I feel like the situation women are in now lends itself to a lot of good fiction. And you also just sometimes want a break. You want a change of gears. I wrote some contemporaries for that reason. I write Scottish contemporaries for that reason, as sort of a palate cleanser, you know, a little recess from horses and dukes and teapots and the world that a Regency romance is written in, or a Victorian romance for that matter. So, yeah, I am tempted to write women's fiction. I'm tempted to write nonfiction.
Okay, well, what would you write nonfiction about?
I don't think there are too many people who have spent 25 years in a child welfare courtroom, also been a single mom, an unwed single mom, at this particular time in history. And there are themes upon which I have perspective that probably larger society isn't hearing from too much. This filters into my romance writing in terms of the roles of women and men and what constitutes adulthood. But the message can be purified if I come at it as a first person sort of autobiography.
And that's really interesting. And I actually think talking about those issues filtering into your writing even now in romance leads us into A Rogue of Her Own very easily, which is your upcoming release. And this is about the fourth Wyndham sister, Charlotte. And she actually is very civic-minded. She's trying to help poor women who end up pregnant and wants to really improve the society around her. So would you like to give us a little summary of A Rogue of Her Own in your own words?
Oh, I like this book. Charlotte Wyndham is the last of 12 cousins who remains unmarried. And the family is sort of making a project of her. Poor Charlotte, we have to find her a husband. Well, Charlotte's about as charming as a hedgehog. But as a girl in what we would call high school or finishing school, she had a best friend. And they were, you know, sort of that friend you'll be able to giggle with in 30 years, 60 years. And this her friend got tangled up with a dishonorable man and was ruined. And Charlotte never forgot that. She never forgot that it was the woman who was judged. It was the woman who was ruined. It was the woman who paid a very high price for trusting the wrong man. And this is part of what makes Charlotte so difficult. She sees that there's a lot of hypocrisy that goes on in polite society. And so she has developed sort of an Underground Railroad reputation for helping women in trouble, particularly poor women for whom an untimely pregnancy is a matter of life or death in Regency England, particularly when the Napoleonic War ended. And there were tremendous casualties in that war. England lost tens of thousands of men. There were many orphans. And in London, these were feral children, and they were everywhere. And there was really no societal solution about what to do for them. The Victorians didn't figure it out. So Charlotte is waging a one-woman battle against a very oppressive darkness. And she marries a man about whom she thinks she has few illusions. He'll be a good provider. She won't be susceptible to any mushy, inconvenient sentiments that could make her do stupid things like many women do when they fall in love, in Charlotte's opinion. And so it's a marriage not quite of convenience, but of pragmatism on her part. And yet she realizes that if her husband was a partner in terms of the goal she's trying to achieve, then she could get so much more done. She could do so much more good. But she has failed to confide in him. She doesn't trust him. She doesn't trust that he won't just judge her along with all the women she's trying to help. So it's a nice book in the sense that there are obstacles keeping two very decent, well-meaning, lovable people apart. And they have to find a way to overcome those obstacles so that they can be decent, well-meaning, and lovable together. And I like a book where neither of the protagonists is particularly villainous. They both have reasons for the positions that they take, and yet they have to find common ground.
That's the perfect description, and there's so much of that that I want to dig into. I defy anyone to read like the first two or three pages and not fall in love with both Charlotte and Lucas. That humor that you alluded to earlier is definitely there with Charlotte, and you know, the book opens with her turning down another proposal, and just that pressure that you talked about with her being the last of 12, that must have been kind of fun. As you were writing all of the others, you had to know you were getting down to that last one, and that her situation ends up being a little bit different from all of the others.
Well, what surprised me about this book, though, is that I am one of seven children. And I am writing this whole book and having a great time. And it doesn't hit me until the book has gone off to the editor. I'm the only one of my siblings who's not married.
That's
oh, my.
Such an interesting parallel.
Well, often I am the last to know that there are autobiographical elements in my books. And it's another enjoyable part of writing. It's self-revelatory.
Well, Sarah and I were discussing that just before we got on with you, whether, you know, Charlotte's cause that she's championing, how much of that was coming from your experience as a child welfare attorney. And, you know, we do live in a different world where it may not be life or death to get pregnant out of wedlock or, you know, in circumstances, but it's still so much more difficult for the woman than it is for the man. And, you know, just how much your experiences have informed that within the book?
Oh, I would say this book is written in part out of my own defining trauma, in that I was an unwed mother. I did not expect to get pregnant. I took all the precautions, and yet still I won the prize. And everything from your sort of childbirth preparation classes to how you register your kid for school assumes the child has two parents on board. At the time, the law in the District of Columbia where I gave birth was that the child had to have my last name. So if the mother was not married, there was no way to give the child her father's name. I hope it's not so true now, that there was stigma attached to, every year I was grateful that my daughter was not in school on Father's Day, because she had nothing except questions and heartache and sorrow where a father should have been. I'm aware that 40% of our children are being raised by single moms. Every one of those single moms is subject to gender wage equality. Every one of those single moms is dealing with pink taxes. Too many of those moms are dealing with harassment in the workplace. Too many of those moms are dealing with gender discrimination, and yet they have the most important job in society, and that is raising our children. So I can get pretty passionate about this.
So I'm curious about, I think I saw somewhere that you normally craft a book starting with the hero's arc and his struggles and then build a heroine off of that. But it sounds like on this one, the heroine came first. Is that right?
That's right. And that's pretty true of the whole Wyndham series, or the Wyndham Bride series, the last four books. The heroines are all red-haired and blue-eyed. And this is an unusual color combination. It's, in fact, the rarest. But my mother had it. And my mother died as I was writing these books. And I made all my heroines red-haired and blue-eyed for her. But also, I have been focusing more on what are women's issues? What are our defining traumas? How were they even present in the Regency and still present today? And boy, is there a lot of overlap.
Yeah, it's sad how much overlap there is. We really like to think, you know, this is history and we have to do research to figure out what it must have been like. But as you've pointed out, your own personal modern day experiences very much inform how you would tell the story of these women long ago. It's unfortunate, but, you know, both as a writer and as an attorney in the profession that you're in, you get a rare opportunity to share some of that with us and, you know, hold up that mirror and let us see it through your eyes.
Well, mostly I want to entertain when I write a book. I want to help you get through that difficult family reunion. I want to get you, through the flight, or, you know, whatever the sort of, whatever is pinching your life. I want you to have a good, fun, hopeful book to read that'll ease the pinch. But I also want to raise some questions. If I can provide an opportunity for people to think, to broaden their perspective, to become more compassionate towards situations where the impulse is to judge, then I feel like I'm pulling my share of the load as a genre fiction author.
Yeah, and you know, those are the pieces that people are so dismissive of, but are so important. And I think people underestimate how much we need that happily ever after, especially as women today, and how much of an impact it can have, whether, you know, you're struggling with postpartum depression is something that we've talked about before. And that happily ever after gives you the guarantee that you've got the entertainment, but it's not going to add to your emotional labor at the end of the book where, you know, it's one more thing that you're processing. It's going to help you to get through it. So I think that's something really beautiful that romance gives us, that it can raise those issues that you're talking about and make us think, but we know at the end of it, we're going to get that reassuring satisfaction of the happily ever after.
Yes, and I think that's not just unique to romance. When you think of Agatha Christie mysteries, for many of them, the heroine is female. She's solving murders. She's doing what the cops can't do. That's a hopeful message. You know, that's you don't think of it as subversive or feminist or humanist, but her books were sure popular. They still are.
I think it's kind of a shame that female-driven fiction is considered subversive. I know there have been a lot of think pieces coming out lately about romance and the resistance and the Me Too movement and how it's sort of this feminist progressive force, which is wonderful, but also so telling that female-centric narratives aren't considered the norm, whereas I've been seeking out female-centric narratives since I was a child, and that's inevitably led me into genre fiction and fantasy and romance and all of that. Did you seek out female-centric narratives when you were first starting to read? Is that sort of what kept you reading romance?
Well, when I was first starting to read, the whole concept of a female-centric narrative did not exist. I read The Hardy Boys. I thought Nancy Drew was a pansy. And, I wanted interesting stories, and Nancy Drew didn't deliver. I'll probably get in trouble for saying this, but I do not regard romance as centrally feminist. I regard it as humanist. And it is a reflection on our unbalanced society that in order to achieve a humanist end, you must be feminist. What do I mean by that? At the end of a romance novel, the hero has grown and changed. The heroine has grown and changed. Neither one of them has what they wanted at the beginning of the book on the terms that they wanted it. They are different people. They are different people because they have found the courage to enter into an intimate relationship on loving terms. And now there is something greater than the sum of the parts. There is the loving, committed relationship. And it changes them and empowers them to be the best people they can be. That's about both of them. That's about everybody giving ground. That's about everybody growing together. It isn't just about women. But the fact that women have to be viewed as the neglected half of that equation, it's just a sadness. It's a deficiency in our culture. But I don't think it makes romance feminist.
I think a lot of this, there's an interesting debate to be had about the term feminism, because for people who don't identify as feminists or perhaps, you know, don't engage with those issues as much, some people assume it means that we want women to be superior to everything, to have more advantages. And the truth is that feminism is about equality, and it is about lifting up everyone so that, you know, feminism says that men should have the freedom to have emotions. Like, we want to address all of the issues that plague everyone and make it an unequal society, but we do have this limited vocabulary with which to address it, because the truth is there are so many issues related specifically to women that need to be fixed that we just need to put a label on it so we can talk about it. And I think it's sort of the same thing with, with like Black Lives Matter. People who say all lives matter, you know, if someone's house is burning down, you're not going to say, well, forget that house, all houses matter. We should be using a wider, more inclusive language about all houses in general. It's like, no, like you have to make the language more precise in order to talk about these problems. I mean, maybe you disagree. I know a lot of people disagree. I personally find the term feminist to be a helpful one, so long as people understand that the ultimate goal, like, yes, is humanism. In an ideal world, that would be what we call it. I'm just not sure that we can call it that right now.
Well, when we call it feminism, we ignore the fact that 16% of our readers are not female. We also, I think, paint ourselves into a corner, because you can't say on the one hand, I am inclusive, I am in favor of diversity, I want romance to include everybody, but it's feminist. And that sets you up in opposition. when I think opposition itself is counter to the message of romance, which is love and courage. And there is no gender associated with being brave and loving. There is simply humanity. But, you know, we could probably go off on this tangent for a long time.
That's true.
Yeah, we should probably spare ourselves and circle back in another direction, unless, you know, it's something that you want to keep digging into. It's just such a complex issue. And as you say, you don't want to alienate anyone or, you know, shut anyone out or make them feel like it isn't for them because you're trying to make it for someone else. So
I also think we're trying to use patriarchal nomenclature to discuss it. And I think you mentioned earlier that it's one of the challenges is developing inclusive vocabulary or developing accurate vocabulary and just starting that process.
Yeah. So I guess switching directions a little bit, you have a newsletter on your website. And actually, if anyone hasn't been to your website, can I just suggest that everyone goes and takes a look at it? I usually get caught up in authors' books that we're reading or whatever, but I ended up in such a black hole on your blog and your bio. And there's just so much really wise content there that I think everyone would enjoy. So if anyone hasn't checked out Grace's blog especially, please go do that.
Thank you.
But you have a newsletter that you send out that's specifically for aspiring authors.
I do.
And it seems like that means you've got a lot of advice, but if you could maybe zero in on some of the most impactful advice you think there is for aspiring authors, is that something you could share with us?
Certainly. Always work on your craft. You know, because no one is ever done learning how to write. But also, if you aren't published yet, you may be surprised at the expectation that you meet with upon publication, and that is that you have your craft in a bag. Nobody's going to teach you how to write. The editor may make some line edits. She may have, or he may have, architectural suggestions, but the supposition is that you're in charge of your craft. So enjoy that, own it, have a great time with it. But the other side of the coin is you will do well that which you love to do. So if first person is the natural voice for you, write in first person. If 60,000 words is just what your stories end up being, write 60,000 word stories. Because this business is too hard. There are too many things you can't manipulate, that you can't get around, that you will never enjoy, for the writing to become another area where you impose strictures upon yourself that will kill your joy. Do what you love. You will get good at it.
And then how would you recommend people overcome writer's block or the tendency to procrastinate?
That's a tougher question than you think. Often writer's block is not writer's block. The advice that I just gave, do what you love, you'll do it well. You don't hear it in kindergarten. You don't hear it on career day. You don't hear it when you're choosing a major in college. So the whole idea that writing is going to be on a different basis. It's going to be about what you think is important. It's going to proceed at your pace. It's going to end up where you want it to end up, or it's going to tend in that direction. We have no roadmaps for this. We have very few social norms around how to be a creative. You can be a crazy artist, but almost by definition, if you're a creative, you don't fit the mold. And this is terrifying. It's very hard to learn your process. And just because you're not writing, that doesn't mean you aren't a writer. You are a parent, whether you are changing a diaper or not. I'm a lawyer, whether I'm in courtroom attire or not. It's part of who I am. And those long stretches where no words are showing up, you are still composting content. You are still absorbing material. You are still learning craft. You are incubating the next great book. So I think a lot of writer's block isn't writer's block. It's just a process that doesn't admit of commoditization. 2,000 words a day, or, you know, you're not a good person. This is ridiculous. And there's some people for whom that will work. They have to have goals. They have to have a schedule. They have to have structure. There are other people for whom you might as well, you know, drop them in the Mariana Trench in terms of fostering their creativity by imposing that kind of structure on them. So I would say the first response to writer's block is don't look at it as writer's block. Look at it as my process is doing something now. What's it doing? Because nobody writes all the time. Everybody has to sleep. Everybody has to deal with, you know, hygiene. How many of us have gotten great ideas in the shower?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think I would encourage people who are not putting out a lot of words right now, don't worry about it. Life is hard, but life is also long. And now might not be the time to write 4 books a year. Margaret Mitchell wrote 1 book and retired. The objective is to write 1 good book. Because if you write a bad book, you will have done more harm than good. You know, so I would just don't be as concerned about writer's block. Be concerned about what process works for you.
It's so refreshing to hear. And it's such a good point that I don't think we had really considered before, that like we're trying to impose these really non-creative friendly processes on a creative process. And, you know, with like strict word counts and expectations, and putting that kind of pressure is not necessarily the best way to get a natural, authentic, creative output. And as you say, you are writing when you're just walking down the street and you're contemplating your characters. So, you know, take some of that pressure off and maybe the writing will come.
Well, if you're writing for publication, you are writing a commercial product. And all of corporate culture comes and sits on top of your book. And, you know, hence you must have deadlines and you must have a certain level of quality and you must deliver on a certain promise. But before you open that Pandora's box of the book's commercial identity, you have all the freedom in the world. And, you know, that's where your best work will be done, where you don't have that corporate culture sort of vulturing on top of your book, telling it what to be and when to be and how long to be and what color to be. You know, it's just, it's a real tough balance to keep a boundary between the industry and the artist.
That's such a good way of putting it. It seems like this wisdom has come through years of experience and, you know, being part of that marketplace and understanding where that writing is coming from for you. And it makes me think of an answer you gave in another interview where you said, the older I get, the happier I am and the more passionate. And then you kind of expounded upon that being unexpected. Could you maybe share a little bit of that thought process with us? That's not what we're used to hearing. I think we're used to hearing about women feeling invisible as they get older.
How sad. But I know where that comes from too. I feel as if, as the reproductive identity has fallen away, as the maternal identity has fallen away, as even the daughter identity has fallen away, what's left is more of the genuine human being that was always there, but was obscured by cultural roles. And I don't have big material wants. I live in a tiny house. I drive a 10-year-old car. And this has left me free to do with my time more and more what I want to do with my time. To me, the greatest form of wealth is unstructured time, where nobody is telling you what to do or where to be or what to wear. I started riding horses again lately. I loved horses. And I realized that in terms of my professional life, I have worked for Halliburton. I have worked for 3 different Fortune 100 companies. The only place outside my house where what I am wearing is entirely for my comfort or my safety is the horse barn. Everywhere else, the courtroom, you know, the corporate open office plan, I must even clothe myself for the convenience of others. And that's not something you're allowed to see as a younger woman. You just have to get to work on time. You just have to pick up the dry cleaning. You cannot let the daycare mom down. There is so much immediate pressure put on younger women and younger men, but especially younger women, to be what is convenient for society. And as a function, as a result of that, we have ended up with a very troubled society because women are not allowed to be themselves. And that, as I am older and increasingly independent of societally dictated roles, I am more and more free to see and say my truth. And this is great fun.
That is so powerful. And I think that's one I'm going to be pondering for the rest of the day. You know, as a woman who is, I've just become a mother and I'm just feeling the weight.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Well, I say that I have a 2-year-old. We're about to move on to number 2, but, you know, just feeling the weight and the pressure of all of that on top of those other pressures that haven't gone away yet, knowing that, you know, there is a point where you just get to be you is refreshing to hear.
Well, I'm lucky that I am approaching my dotage at a time when we're beginning to research women's roles, even in couples where the agreement is we are splitting the chores 50-50 and we've made a list. When you actually go in and look at those households, dad is doing about 30% of the chores, mom is doing 70%. And they think it's 50-50. And that to me is a metaphor for a much larger picture. And, you know, on behalf of particularly the millennial generation and the generation immediately below me, I want to help fix that.
Yeah.
I want to help bring a little more equity to the situation. I want men to have more options. I don't want them dying 7 years sooner than women do. I want us all around having a good time. And I think romance novels are my way to make a contribution.
I love that. And it's so important. And I think it has more impact than a lot of people realize. So thank you for putting that out there to the world. It's so important to hear.
It's my pleasure.
We want to be conscious of your time. So we wrap up our interviews with a set of 10 sort of random questions just to see if we can get to know you a little bit better. So the first question we have is, what is the most interesting thing that's in your workspace, wherever that space is?
Oh, a pair of cats.
Well, what are their names?
Let me see who it is, because they're all kind of tangled up. One of them is Toes and the other is Cinnamon.
Toes. Does he have the normal amount of toes or more toes than normal?
She is a litter of toes, ankle boots, knee socks. They all have different degrees of white on their front paws.
Oh my gosh. that's really adorable. Okay, second question. Is there anything you irrationally hate?
Intolerance.
That's a really good answer.
No, I should say I get very upset about a determinedly closed mind. You know, I want in, I want air, I want light, I want to fix this. And you can't, because people are often closed down out of terror, out of weakness, out of pain. And you can't go at it with a sledgehammer. That doesn't work. You have to go at it with love. So, yeah, I also have a master's degree in conflict. And that's been a helpful thing to have as a romance writer.
Well, and that answer you just gave, I was thinking more of your work as an attorney and how with kids, you usually still have that window of an open mind. And, you know, they haven't necessarily closed it off yet, but through some of the trauma and their experiences and not getting that love, it can close the window. So,
well, your heart just aches for their parents, because many times their parents are poor souls and they will stand up in court and say, Your Honor, I was beaten. I was passed around from one relative to the other. I never got past eighth grade, and I turned out fine. And it's like, Mom, you can barely read. Most of your boyfriends are in prison. You're not in good health. You have so much unresolved trauma. You are not fine.
Yeah.
But, you know, we still expect you to be a mom. And it's just heartbreaking.
That's really tough. But hopefully you're at least able to affect some change with the kids and, you know, maybe get them a better situation.
We just keep trying.
Yeah.
Because for sure, if you give up, nothing changes.
Yeah. Okay, so question three. The zombie apocalypse is happening, and you can only save one work of fiction that is not your own. What would it be?
Joanna Bourne's The Black Hawk.
I haven't read that one, but now I'm going to have to immediately go get it.
All right, and then who is your favorite book boyfriend from a book you didn't write?
Mary Balog's The Duke of Bewcastle. Wulfric Bedwin.
Oh, yes. Oh, he's a good one.
Would you rather be forgotten or hatefully remembered?
Forgotten.
All right. Who was your first celebrity crush?
Probably Robert Conrad in The Wild Wild West. He's apparently not a pleasant man, or he wasn't, but he made a good cowboy secret agent.
Cowboy secret agent. I think we need more of those. All right. You might have actually answered this earlier in the interview, but we go out to a bar together. What would your drink of choice be?
That depends. I do like White Russians. However, I also am curious about single malt scotch. And I like unpeated lowland scotch. So I might, if they had an interesting one on offer, I might try that.
Which I would say not many bars probably do, because Sarah and I both love scotch, and it's usually the sort of same selection that you get within the bar. But unpeated lowland, so like a sort of lighter, sweeter, maybe a little bit floral scotch,
right? Or a Speyside, they can be fun too. I just stay away from the smoke.
Which is, if it doesn't have smoke, I'm not interested. I love a really smoky, peaty Islay scotch.
I did have a really good unpeated scotch years ago from, I think, the Orkney Islands called Scapa. And that was good. Yeah. But normally I also go for the heavy smoke. So, but all scotch is good scotch. Okay. Next question. What Hogwarts house would you be in?
I do not know.
And I feel like usually by this point in the interview, Sarah and I have a pretty good sense. And I'm not sure with you.
I'm going to say Gryffindor, because Gryffindors are sort of on a crusade to make the world better. So Gryffindor's house is all about courage. And so you get a lot of idealists who are action oriented. And that sounds like you to me.
I could see that.
I don't know. I certainly don't look like a Gryffindor. I mean, I think there's... We make false dichotomies. You can be a Hufflepuff and a Gryffindor.
Yeah, and I think that's maybe what I'm getting, like, you're sort of a mixture of, and that's the point you're making, we all are, but yeah, if we had to sort you, I don't know. Would you rather have invisibility or super strength?
Invisibility.
And we said 10 questions and we skipped one because we realized we were going to ask you a question about, you had to choose actors, and since you've said you don't watch TV, that was going to be a dead end, so we've left that one out. But yeah, so if people want to follow you or learn more about your books or anything, I've alluded to your website, so we'll definitely put that in the show notes. Where else can they find you?
I am on Facebook. I am on Twitter. I tend to keep it pretty romance author, but if other writers want to connect, they can email me from my website, and I love to hear from other authors. There's all kinds of fun stuff going on out there, and I tend to put my nose down in a book and or a manuscript, and I want for connection with other people who do what I do.
I think so many do, just knowing that other people are struggling with the same things. Do you still attend any of the RWA conferences or chapter meetings or anything?
Yes, I will be at RWA National in July. I am also speaking at the RWA conferences in New Zealand and Australia in August. And that's going to be so much fun.
That is so exciting. Have you been before?
No.
Oh, I haven't been to Australia, but I'm fiending to get back to New Zealand after we took a trip there a couple of years ago, and it's the most incredible place in the world. It's unreal. So excited to hear what you think of that.
I can't wait.
All right. Well, A Rogue of Her Own is out now, so everyone should go and check that out. Charlotte and Lucas are just beyond charming, and their story is wonderful. And thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thank you both very much. It's been a pleasure.